Hello, and welcome to the Writers and Illustrators of the Future podcast. This is John Goodwin, your host. This podcast is dedicated to the aspiring writer and artist, and will provide inspiration and tips from top professionals in the field. If you've been listening to this podcast or are new to it, I thank you very much. I would also appreciate it if you took a moment to follow on whatever platform you use to listen to your podcasts. Writers and Illustrators of the Future is one of the longest-running writing competitions in the world, now celebrating four decades of providing a helping hand as initially conceived by L. Ron Hubbard. I also want to let you know that the Writers of the Future volumes are available in bookstores throughout the U.S., Canada, the U.K., South Africa, and Australia, as well as through all major online retailers. Today's guest is Mark Leslie, a co-founder of the Superstars Writing Seminars, and we are here in Colorado Springs for the 2024 Superstars Conference. Mark has been a guest on his podcast a few times in the past. Mark, by his own admission, is a writer, author coach, speaker, podcaster, publisher, and all-around book nerd. He has been a good friend for probably two decades and was a keynote speaker for Writers of the Future when he was an exec at Kobo, one of his several past lives. Welcome, Mark.
John, always great to see you.
Great, thanks. And now, as has been well established, I'm a serious fan of your Canadian Werewolf series and just finished volume six.
I'll slip you the $50 later. Thank you.
Sure. Hex and the City. The saga of Michael Andrews and Gail Summers takes on a whole new level of paranormal, and it gets cooler for me because I love paranormal. I love magic, you know, and
yeah,
it's something that Andre Norton gave my first love for it way back when.
Me too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Witch World series, I read it a couple times, and it was such an amazing start to the whole thing. So before we get into the interview, please provide an overview of your career in publishing, because this is so impressive.
Yeah, so I've always loved storytelling. Since the youngest days, I used to tell stories with little Fisher-Price figurines. I later on discovered the magic of doing little stick figure cartoons. And the magic was the story wasn't just in my head anymore. It was something I could put on a piece of paper and somebody else could appreciate it at a later date, as
right.
We know
yeah.
of legacy writers whose words are still here to this day. And then I discovered my mom's old Underwood typewriter under a dust cover in the back closet. And I hammered out my very first novel at the age of 13. A horrible novel, but
a novel.
To me it was an epic fantasy Dungeons and Dragons style adventure. And I started writing speculative fiction, horror, stuff like that. And I got my first rejection at the age of 15. And I realized it was like this really nasty horror story to CBC Radio, a radio contest for young writers. And they're like NPR in Canada. And I realized that if I actually did any market research, I would have realized that no, literary stories work, not horror.
Right.
And so that's just been my life. I went into bookselling. I graduated from university in 1992, and my parents knew I always wanted to be a writer, and my mom gave me this advice. I still remember, if you want to be a writer, then you better have a good job, because that is the reality for most people in the industry. But I was always passionate about writing, and I gravitated towards English literature, which meant I was qualified either to go into teacher's college and teach or work in retail, and I chose retail bookselling. In 1992, so after hundreds of rejections on short stories, because this was back in the day when there were no self-publishing options. It was get a manuscript, build a name for yourself with short story markets. And I had had, hundreds of rejections from the age of 15 until I was graduating from university. So in 1992, I graduated university, started working in a bookstore, and that was the year my very short story, a very first short story, for $5 US and a copy of the magazine in Chapter One Digest, a quarterly digest magazine.
From the publishing chain?
Publishing. That was the first publication. And it was a YA humor story. And that was the beginning of my first sale. And of course, it went on from there as I continued to sell stories. And then I released my first book in 2004. And it was self-published, and I took a lot of my...
So that was from 92 to 2004?
Yeah, and I'd had dozens of stories, several dozen stories published, and many more hundred rejections
yeah.
over the years. And I got to a point, I was working in bookstores, And people would say, so you're a bookseller or you're an author. And I would say, yes, I am. And they'd look around the bookstore and say, where can I find your stuff? And I'd say, well, okay, I got a quest for you. It's in a small press magazine published in upstate New York. I was living in Ontario, Canada. And I said, and if you drive down across the border, you're 3 hours south, and you go, there's Black River, upstate New York. There's a little shop that has it on a rack. I said, oh no, it's February now. It was only on the shelf for January. It's gone now. And I got really frustrated that my work was there, but it was never permanent. So I, Rob Sawyer, you know, one of the Writers of the Future's judges, Julie Cherneda, Rob Sawyer, Edo Van Belkom, and Nancy Kilpatrick were four Canadian author mentors of mine who advised me against self-publishing because no one would ever take you seriously because that was the going wisdom at
back
the time.
Back then it was Vanity Press.
And yet, here's what I love about writers. They still all gave me a blurb because they knew my fiction. They'd either bought my fiction for whatever markets that they were working on and they knew my stuff. And they still gave me a blurb. So I self-published my first book, One Hand Screaming, a collection of horror stories. I did that in 2004. And ever since then, I have traditional deals with several different publishers. And none of the big six, but smaller publishers. And also have self-published. And so I've never looked back. I am a storyteller. And I have a good job.
You do indeed have a good job. So you've got going from short story to a novel. Because it started as a short story, right?
Yeah, Canadian Werewolf in New York was a 10,000-word story originally written for a market that was, I think it was called The Monster Within or The Man Behind the Monster. And they wanted stories about like Jekyll and Hyde or whatever, but they wanted the man, not the monster. They wanted to see the man but beneath the beast. The Beast Within, it might have been called. I'm trying to remember now.
Yeah,
I didn't get accepted. I got a rejection for it, but I had been working with some friends, I think at Kobo at the time, in Toronto, Canada's answer to Kindle, and a couple of my colleagues who were from New York. And I said, well, this story's set in New York, and I'd written it shortly after my first visit, and I fell in love with the city. And I said, can you just read it to see how realistic, like, did I get things right about the culture and the people? Because you guys live there. And one of them loved it so much. And she started prompting me for more stories. And then I shared this with Sean Costello, a Canadian horror author, a mentor of mine. And he says, great story. What happens next? And I said, nothing. It's over. He, you know, the short story ends as he gets to his morning breakfast. And that was the whole goal. And it was meant to be cheeky and funny. He goes, but what happens the rest of his day? And he asked these questions and he kept hounding me, a wolf reference maybe. and that's when the novel A Canadian Werewolf is born. So I took the 10,000 word story and I said, okay, why did his agent want to meet him? Maybe he needs to be on David Letterman. Okay, that sounds good. And the rest was history. But I turned it into the single day in the life of the man behind the wolf.
Right.
And as you know, it kind of took off from there.
Kind of did for reals. Six books later. So now you gone from short story to novel to a series, which you just alluded to there.
Yeah.
And now you got co-authors happening. So
yeah.
So this is kind of like I mentioned to you beforehand, like, you know, that Yogi Berra quote, when you come to a fork in the road, take it. And I'd like to talk about that because even though it's maybe a silly quote, it's actually kind of pertinent here because you've continued to grow this story concept, and it can apply to any story concept. I know that like David Hankins has got his short story that got published in Volume 39, which is really
Death
fun.
And
Death
and Tax Man. Yeah, I know. And I have the full length novel adaptation.
You have the novel now.
Yeah.
And it's going to continue growing. So like how you've taken your short story, made a novel, you have a series, and now you've got co-authors as part of this as well to grow. And from the last thing I read, it's branching. You know?
Yeah.
You know, so you got Gail going in one direction, you got Michael, they're still interweaving, but you've got a whole sub-series now going with Gail.
Yeah, yeah.
And her story as Michael continues his. So talk to me about that, how that's evolved, because this is something that's applicable to other authors too, like how, you know, don't restrict yourself on what you can actually do. What's the possibilities?
Yeah, so that was interesting. So Julie is a great writer, romance writer, friend of mine, great friend, a book nerd like me. We share that in common. And she has edited my work and was familiar with Canadian Werewolf because she's helped me with things. And I went to write the story, which was a backstory to how Gail and Michael and Gail first met and fell in love. Because I had readers who liked the tension. Michael was still in love with her, but she didn't want anything to do with him. And they were friends because at least he could have her as a friend. And he took that. And there was that sadness, the Peter Parker loser kind of aspect. Thank you, Stanley. And I tried to write Lover's Moon, and it was initially going to be a short story just for my fans, just to say, here's the story. And I couldn't write Gail. I, like Michael, put Gail up on the highest pedestal. I couldn't reach her, loved her, worshipped the ground she walked on. I couldn't write a proper character because characters have to have flaws. They have to be real. And Gail was too perfect because Gail modeled very much on my partner, Liz. I see her perfections, you know. And I talked to Julie and I said, you know, you're very familiar with this series. Would you like to write Gail's point of view? So we wrote it as a duet, chapter by chapter, male point of view, female point of view. That was great. Wonderful story. We talked about that one. And then the next book, Hex in the City, was supposed to be me writing what happens next. And I realized it would be more interesting to have Gail's point of view because I liked her point of view. Julie brought something new to Gail, a multidimensionality that I could never have done. Mm-hmm. I loved her even more with her imperfections. And then I reached out to Julie and I said, would you like to write Gail again? And she goes, but I don't write thriller, urban paranormal thriller stuff. And I go, well, yeah, but you write humor really well because all of her romance had, and Lover's Moon, romantic comedy, lots of those elements. And I said, I don't think I could ever write Gail the way you did. So I won't be able to write her point of view. I can't. The only way I can do this. And Hex in the City was born. And as we mapped this out and plotted it out, and she learned that she liked writing this adventure, action adventure, thriller, humor stuff. That's when we got to the end of Hex in the City, and Gail has to go on a quest separate from Michael. And Julie goes, I love Gail so much. Can I write those novels? And I was honored because I want to know what happens.
Yeah.
And Julie's the one to tell me now. So I think there's a trust. An element of trust, you like a partner, that the right editor, the right writing partner to co-author together, that I can take a character that I love and worship so much and trust Gail and trust that Julie will do right by Gail. And she pulled some things in Hex in the City, and she was worried as we were round robining the book back and forth, like we wrote it in sequence. Mm-hmm. And she's like waiting for me for this shock thing that happens. She goes, I don't know if you're going to like this. And I put the manuscript down and I just said, Julie, you blew my mind. I think the readers' minds are going to be blown too. This was phenomenal. And she was worried I was going to be upset and ask her to remove it. So I don't know. I think that the way that branches, like you said, from story to novel to collaboration, and then to see Julie take inspiration in a whole new direction is just, it's magic.
Yeah. I mean, that's definitely what it is. But this concept, because we talked about it before, on when you come to a fork in the road, take it. And it can be kind of like a very scary proposition. But we talked about the subject of the more you actually learn and become knowledgeable about what you're doing, the more you can know that you're, when you take the fork, you're actually taking the right, doing the right thing.
Yeah.
And so I think for a storyteller, somebody wants to get into and to take the next level up on writing, what are some of the safeguards to help ensure that you do take the right fork when you take the fork in the road?
Oh, yeah, that's a great question. And it's a difficult one because it almost feels like you don't even know if there's a fork there until you start to take it sometimes. Right. And that's when you realize it. And there's a feeling. So if we take, and by the way, I was born the same day Yogi Berra, so.
Okay, good. So that's very, perfect, even all the more
fitting. Very apropos, but also speaking of forks and roads, the road not taken is also, so if we look at that and just wonder, well, what's down that path? I'm a huge fan of Henry David Thoreau and his walking and exploring and going on these epic journeys on foot. And I equate writing to the very same thing because you know, looking at, you know, Dean Wesley Smith's, you know, writing Into the Dark or exploratory writing, oftentimes I don't know where this path is going to take me, but I just take it and see what happens. Sometimes, and this is a tough thing for writers, especially new writers, is sometimes I'll go down a path and I'll realize, oh, no, that didn't work. And I have to, you know, murder your darlings. I have to get rid of that because it was a little element. But advice I would give to writers is you learned in that experience. You go back and you try a different path. And that could also be a bonus content for your diehard fans to say, oh, by the way, I cut this chapter because this thing was supposed to happen, but it's like the deleted scenes in a movie. And the fans may want that because it's exciting. Oh, this could have happened. This was the alternate ending or whatever. So not only is that a valuable experience of learning as a writer, and every word you lay on paper is a valuable experience because you're getting better and better as you go. Maybe that content could be leveraged in some other way. I'm a big fan of recycling my own work.
Good, yeah. So, like I mentioned to you when we were talking about before coming into this, I really didn't see where Hex in the City was going. It was a bit, definitely a surprise, and it's very obvious that there's new stories following it. It definitely was not an end. You had a good conclusion to that, what was happening right there, and your denouement was fine. But then you just had that question at the very end. It goes, oh man,
yeah.
You can't not, you know, yeah. You've got to read the next book now.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so on that then, so when you started your series, did you know it was going to be 8 or 10, or did you have... It was going to be a short story, and then someone convinced you to make a novel, and then you said, okay, I'll do a series, which the magic number is 3, but now 6 into it, 7 has to be done, but because there's 7 and what's happening now, it's going to at least go up to 10. How's that rolled out for you?
In that exploring the path and wondering where it's going to take me, I thought A Canadian Werewolf in New York was a standalone novel.
Yeah.
It was an editor wanting a short story on a theme. Monster road trip that inspired Stowaway.
And, which we're going to get back to.
And then one of the things I've always loved about certain TV series, I'm rewatching Frasier, the original Frasier show.
Uh-huh.
And Niles is in love with Daphne, the physical therapist working with his father. And it's really cool. I love the story of the just really the love that doesn't quite connect, and you root for them and want them to be together. And readers had that with Michael and Gail. Michael and Gail get together. We can't have that. We have to throw something at them because it's no fun if they're not challenged. And also, we also set up in Hex in the City a curse that has a dramatic impact that prevents this.
Right.
And they learn a little bit about why some things happened in the past, which was not planned at all. Julie and I, when we were writing Lover's Moon, had some ideas. Oh, this is why. It had nothing to do with Lover's Moon, but we needed to know the characters better, so we just did a lot of brainstorming. And we created a couple things. So just like the bad guys in Fear and Longing in Los Angeles and Fright Night's Big City, they're still out there. They're going to come back. There are these cursed items that still need to be found. So there's all kinds of adventures that can be had.
And then you have this, we've mentioned too, there's one person that, did she die? Did she not die?
Yeah, exactly. And I did that on purpose without knowing, but now it's open because if the body's never found, there's always the possibility that it was a misunderstanding and maybe they weren't dead. So that's, I like having the possibility, because I don't plan, I love having the possibility of what could happen.
Right. Now, just quickly taking back to this, your Stowaway character,
mm-hmm.
I love her, and
oh, yes.
You haven't brought her back yet. She's such a cute kid. She's smart, she's quirky, you know, she's... Nobody's, you know, she's very independent and she's very much not with me right now.
I know. And Bridge was a funny character because this has happened to me several times in my career. she was meant to be a prop character, a device. Mm-hmm. There's a wolf predator on a train, and there's a young child followed by a human predator, and the wolf predator is going to save her from the human predator. The minute she opened her mouth and first spoke, she jumped out at me, and she created her. She didn't come from me. I don't know where she came from, but she, and I love that kid so much. And yeah. She became a mentor to Michael, and she's such a powerful character that I want her to return, but I want it to be in the right way. I don't want to bring her back just because it pleases the fan or not. You know what I mean? Because it meets whatever. I need it to be important because Bridge is such an important character. I mean, she does ask Michael. She gets him to face the reality of his situation with Gale, even though he still can't. He's not strong enough to make it happen. Bridge will be coming back, and I'm glad you love her as much as I did, because the kid just grew on me instantly.
Yeah, and the reason I bring this up, because this is you started as a device which kind of like really exploded, and for somebody who's a writer that wants to be, you know, how do you evolve and how to develop stuff, this is something that in real time happened that I experienced, and you know, what they need to do, what they should do to take advantage of that. Because this is, again, this, when you come to a fork in the road, take it. So, you know, you're not taking it yet, but it's definitely in the runway for you.
Yeah.
But that's just how good storytelling can kind of open up these directions and paths that you don't really see coming until they just arrived.
Yeah, like I didn't know. I had the issue of the train's going to get there. He's going to turn into a wolf. How is he going to protect her? And this is the first person he openly admits he's a wolf to. That's a very intimate trust thing. Mm-hmm. That's how important she becomes to him that quickly. And that I didn't know that was going to happen. And so I think it's so fun when as you're creating something, it comes. It's almost like, I think it's important for writers to trust, even if they're scared and they can't see down that path, trust that when they get there, they themselves, some energy of the muse in that's part of them, mm-hmm. will light that path at the right time and allow them to keep going.
Exactly. And I was just talking with Jim Butcher this afternoon on a separate interview, and we were talking about characterization and, you know, really building people that to a degree are bigger than life. And his stuff is kind of pulpy, and pulp is very much that.
His stuff is amazing.
Yeah, and this follows along that same type of concept.
Yeah.
But it's even more important now, and I'd like you to discuss this too, of like there's so much divisiveness in society today, and media has gotten so bad, so egregious on the subject of the scareheads.
Yeah.
And taking something... You can have an incident, it's not good, but then they take it and they expand it to something really bad to be able to get your attention. And so fiction is hard-pressed to be able to compete against that unless it is bigger than life or someone other that there's some very much big standout. And so like this girl, you know, Bridge is like, she's like that. You know, Michael is definitely like that. And he's got his shortcomings and he's got his strengths. And but just talk to me about that too, the importance of characterization, having something that is big, that is going to stand out, because you're trying to compete for a person's attention.
Yeah.
And there's so many demands for the attention just on right, especially today with all the bad news that's happening globally.
Yeah. It's funny you mentioned Jim Butcher, because I've had readers enjoy... a similarity to the Dresden sardonic, not quite, but there's that voice. And so there's that wonderful connection there. But the other thing, I think the reason Michael pops for people is I really, when I created him, I wanted to understand how the average person who's not a hero deals with a side effect of having a condition that he cannot control. I grew up with epilepsy. I had epilepsy my whole life, and well, my whole life until I was 14 was when I had my last seizure. But I had instances of understanding what it was like to not have control. And so part of Michael turning into a wolf is he has no idea what happened. And that's sort of, I think people can understand that. Well, not they don't have to have had epilepsy, but there are things they have control over
mm-hmm.
and they don't know about and they have no control over. And so I think there's a universality there, but also the way that you, I have this thing I have to deal with and that's my cross to bear. And everyone has those in different mm-hmm. ways. But also I think that people recognize is it's not all doom and gloom. It's going to be funny sometimes. Like I have friends who have, you know, I'm able-bodied, but I have friends who have disabilities in their ability of motion and stuff like that. And they, you know, and it seems like cruel, but they have a lot of fun and enjoy, you know, they make fun of themselves in a way. Like I talk about my baldness and stuff like that, right? It's sort of a fun thing. And it feels more genuine because it's not all one monotone mm-hmm. way. I think about funerals, you know, my father's funeral and everyone's, we're laughing and telling stories and it's supposed to be a sad time and emotions are going everywhere. I was talking on a panel with Jonathan Mayberry earlier today and we talked about that in horror, that you can't just have a monotone thing of tension. You have to go have the ups and downs and the different notes, and it's like this melody. Mm-hmm. And so I think those are the aspects in a character that are like the people we know and love and are in our worlds. They're you know, nobody is perfect, even though we like to see some people as perfect. But then there's the that recognition that, oh yeah, oh yeah, that, yeah, me too. I got that too. I don't know. That's something I enjoy in stories.
Right. So on, now I've talked, what I'm familiar with is the whole, you know, series, the Canadian Werewolf series. That's not the only series you write. So how is it that you're able to write and juggle different storylines? How does that work for you?
Well, that's a great question. So, up until this point, it wasn't until I got to only Monsters in the Building, which is being worked on right now, and another short story request for a collection, that I realized this story has to take place between Canadian Werewolf in New York and Stowaway. I had to do a timeline and a map because it's getting complicated, because I said, oh, is this before this happened or after this happened? So it had to be here. And I didn't have any sort of outline or Bible for the series. So now that I have that, and I did have one of my editors create a mini sort of Bible for me, so I've got that element too. Most of my other realms, most of my other works are not nearly as long and complex.
Mm-hmm.
So I haven't yet struggled with bouncing back and forth. And I do bounce back and forth between nonfiction, whether it's true ghost stories or movie trivia or whatever, and fiction. But right now, the fiction I'm loving the most and spending the most time with is Michael and his universe.
Okay. So now, you mentioned a Bible. So this is another one of those devices that I've not talked about before with right. On podcasts. So describe what a Bible is and its importance
right.
To you as an author.
So I think, especially as a series gets longer, there are numerous characters, there's settings, there's things that happen. And it's really a guide for the editor working with the writer or the writer themselves to remember. It could be something as simple as the character's eye color. It could be for me recognizing what street does Gail live on, where's her shop. And I have all these things on little maps. It could be something as middle as, oh, no, this isn't like, oh, yeah, Bridge was the first person he admitted this to. You know, Gail found out, but he didn't know she knew, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so those elements can get so bogged down in an 80,000-word text. And you, I mean, even as I go to write the newer story, I have to go back and refer to, what chapter did that happen? Like when he talked to so-and-so, what did they say? Or what did they say their wife's name was? Any of those, like I think of Wikipedia style elements to help you not mess up.
Good. Now, it's interesting. There's this book that Owen Hubbard wrote called Typewriter in the Sky. And it's a parody of that type of a writer who not tracking. So you don't have your Bible, you don't have your your things correct in there. So the author's name was Horace Hackett. You know, he's definitely a hack writer. And he's got these things inconsistent with the timeline. He's got, you know, here you've got, he's got a Steinway piano in the Caribbean before Steinway existed. Mm-hmm. And these different things he puts in there showing that he didn't have his facts straight.
Right.
And every time, you know, he's doing it, when he realizes, oh, this is not going right, he just, the next scene, he changes everything, and it's the wrong setting, the wrong stuff like that. And it pokes fun at hack writers, you know, right, who don't have this stuff straight. So, and Mike Resnick, that was his favorite Hubbard story, because he called it, it was like the first recursive science fiction fantasy story. And while he was able to successfully poke fun of it and make a, you know, the granddaddy of that subgenre, it points out the point that the need to really have your facts straight. So that brings me now to research and, you know, how does that work with you? Because even though it's just fiction, it's fantasy fiction, you know, just go ahead. But I mean, you've got him in various sits, you know, because he's Canadian Werewolf in New York. You know, you've got, you know, the Central Park, you've got on 7th Avenue and 5th, and you've got, you know, the various studios and stuff like that. So how much did you have to research to make sure you get it right? Because if you don't, you're definitely going to hear about it.
Yeah, it's funny because I do a lot of research for, you know, nonfiction paranormal ghost stories, but I do way more research for the Canadian Werewolf series because in L.A., I mean, I've been to LA a couple times, once with Writers of the Future.
Right.
I had him stay at the hotel that I was put up in when I came to visit with you people. And it was a wonderful, I loved that. That was my first stay in Los Angeles, and I loved the city so much. And a lot of the things Michael sees and bars he went to or whatever are places I went. And when I haven't been there or haven't been there enough to know the place or know whatever, I do fastidious research. Google Maps, I walk down the street, look to see if there is a corner store there or if in 2017 there was one there.
Mm-hmm.
Even in one of the novels, I had a scene that took place in a restroom at a diner, and I asked people who lived in New York and went to that diner, is it one of the ones that you go downstairs in? Is it on the main floor? Do you go upstairs? Is it male, female? Are they ambidextrous? I wanted those details as accurate as possible. And that's so critical to me. I can probably fake it. And that's where Julie and I clashed. I'm a pantser. She's a plotter. And yet she would just make things up. And I was like, but they're running for 12 blocks and it's only a block and a half from this place to this place. And I'm very, very anal about those details because I want someone who has walked down the street or stayed in that hotel, you know, right off Hollywood Boulevard or who's done this or been in this restaurant. I want them to be able to go, that's where Michael sat.
That's right.
Like the Algonquin Hotel, the cat, all the details, you know, I had some liberties with it. I made the Barrymore suite a little bit more luxurious than it was, but all the details about the Algonquin Hotel are accurate. And Central Park. When Liz and I go to Central Park, my partner Liz and I wander around and I've laid down on the ground and said, this is where Michael woke up at the beginning of Stowaway. And she's like, you're weird. And yet she still loves me, so that's good.
That works. So from my experience as a reader, when I have that, it's a lot easier for me to suspend my disbelief on the definite fantastical part, because it's mixed in there with a bunch of real things, with real locations, real
celebrities.
Yeah, all that stuff is there. So when you plug this other thing in, I was like, huh. And it makes it so that it's easier to accept it rather than going, oh, this is just, sorry. And like we've said, I'm doing a podcast this week. I'm usually reading a book a week. And so I don't have time to read something that is just kind of like, if it's not worth the author's effort to get it right, it's definitely not worth my effort to bother reading it.
And that's great writing advice right there.
Yeah. You know, if you don't believe in your book enough to actually do your work on it and do it right, to do your due diligence, and all I can say is with my podcast, because it's grown quite a bit since I'm in year four now, but I remember high-fiving when I broke 500 listens, and now each episode gets at least 2 million listens, but I do so much homework before any podcast I do. I read your book. I've read 6 of the books now.
Yeah.
And so it's easy for me to talk about it and have my opinions, and I'll do the interview because I like it. I'm not going to do an interview if I didn't like it, series. But it's because there's things, because I've gone to New York a lot. I live in Los Angeles, so
yeah.
I know what you're talking about. And they're like, wow, okay. So it's easy for me to relate to what's happening there and to be able to accept it. It's escapist, but it's fun. And I can that's cool. It's grounded for me.
Yeah. It's funny. When I listen to this podcast, I can tell you've done your due diligence. You understand, you're not just, your book has a neat cover. You mm-hmm. get into stuff, you probe, you add, very deep research into it, but it creates a unique experience for a very stimulating conversation, and they always are. But also, it as a writer, as an interviewee,
mm-hmm.
it's so enriching and stimulating to know that you've invested that much in it. And I think that comes off, and that's why the readership grows, because they have something valuable that they're getting from it. And that's wonderful, because you are the main interviewer and the main host, in that you're in their, in their heart, mind every week, just like you're sitting across a coffee shop table with them. And that's a magic, like writing itself.
Yeah. So with yourself, if you and anybody listening to stuff as an author, if you're not going to take the time to really get it right, don't be surprised if nobody follows you. If you're not going to invest into it. Craig Markell was talking about this afternoon. I did a panel interview as one of the panels for this was a podcast panel.
Yeah.
And he talked about he put up one of his books as an AI audiobook. And it was, he had 3 of them, 3 stories.
Yeah.
And hasn't sold a book yet.
Yeah.
Hasn't sold one. Nobody's bought it. And so if you're not going to care enough to put some honest to goodness effort and concern and care and wanting to do it right,
yeah.
don't be surprised when it goes nowhere. It falls flat.
Yeah. I mean, what's that saying that you get out of it what you put into it?
Uh-huh.
That seems to be so true.
It is definitely true. So on, you do a lot of seminars and you do a lot of workshops. So what are some of the things you normally get asked? That's a frequent question to yourself.
A common question is people not understanding, should I go with, how do I get an agent, or should I go with a publisher, or I hear that self-publishing is this or that. And often writers mistakenly believe that they have to only do one, and they forget the fact that they have the power and ability to license their IP, their beautiful creative IP, the way they want. And they can do both. I love working with publishers. I love self-publishing. I love the perks and challenges of both. I mean, well, the challenges I don't love as much as the perks, but the challenges also help me learn and grow as a person and writer. And I think the other thing writers often happens with beginning writers that I like to remind them of is, it's okay, you're going to make mistakes. I've made tons of mistakes, and I'm hopefully going to learn from them. And it doesn't mean I can't, try again
mm-hmm.
and keep at it. Like those rejections I always got. I'm going to write things that people aren't going to read, even if I invested in it and even if I did my research. But the way I look at it is that, to me, that magic I talked about earlier of putting something on paper and somebody else being able to appreciate it when I'm not there at another place and time transcends space and time. And it fundamentally does one of the most powerful things we have as humans is connecting people and making somebody feel seen or heard,
mm-hmm.
felt, and connected. And so if that story you wrote doesn't fly off the shelves and become a New York Times bestseller, like several of the other guests you mentioned talking to today, maybe a handful of people or one person read it and it made a difference. When we were having dinner with Kevin Anderson and Rebecca Mesta, Kevin relayed a story of a reader whose life was fundamentally changed and saved.
Saved, yeah.
Because of a series of books that he co-authored with a dear friend of his. That is so beautiful.
And I think it's also important for, like, again, for a writer to understand that if you think you're going to write something that's going to have a broad mass appeal, that is, like, Stephen King has a pretty good appeal. I'm not one of,
right.
I'm not really that big on that type of horror.
Yeah.
You know, I enjoy your storyline. I don't view it particularly as horror. That one there is.
Just because there's a werewolf doesn't mean it's horror.
Right.
Yeah.
It's like, it's almost like comedic urban fantasy for me because of, we'll get into this part here now, on the lyrics that are always popping up throughout your stories.
Yes.
But I think you got to also realize that who you're writing for, who's your audience, and realize that that audience is, if you want a huge cross-section, you're going to have to write something that appeals to that, but also you have a lot more competition. But if you're, if you really dig, you know, writing the werewolf in the Appalachians, then you're going to have an audience for that. It's not going to be as big as, you know, other type of subgenres. So when you went after this this series of the Canadian werewolf, what was the audience, or what were you trying to reach there?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, because I don't know if I knew it consciously, but I do know that I know it's not for everyone. I know there are people not going to enjoy the story, and I made the mistake when I wrote the story of not even recognizing it was urban fantasy. So the first cover I had on A Canadian Werewolf in New York, it was more literary, because I thought, well, you never see him as a wolf. It's just a human, and it's really navel-gazing, and that's very literary. So nobody who reads urban fantasy is going to want this, but nobody who reads literary fiction is going to want this either, I realized. And it wasn't until 4 years. It came out in 2016. It took me over 10 years to get it written from that first short story. And I didn't sell all that many. And it wasn't until I started writing Stowaway that I realized there was a series, and I had a professional artist give me that brand, and I embraced urban fantasy because I realized that it is urban fantasy. Mm-hmm. It's just lighter than, because magic is not as pervasive in this world. It's very subtle and very similar to horror in that, though, in a horror novel, it's usually not set in a...
Until you get to Volume 6, but okay, go ahead.
Yeah, but until... But even then, the average person doesn't realize this is going on. Like, you and I are walking down the street, come from a restaurant, we didn't see the demons fighting in the alleyway beside us.
Right.
And so, yeah, the whole world doesn't... it gets a little scary, but the world is scary.
Yeah.
And so that's the thing, and the world is very subtle. And I was very careful about that with Julie, because she was having stuff happen in the middle of everything. And I was like, no, people see it. I need this to be this world with a little bit of magic here and there, just like we have, as we're like, did I see something there or not? Because we question ourselves of our own reality. So anyways, but those are some of the elements that I think happened to me. And I don't think, when I think of my audience, I'll go back to Stephen King for a second. His audience, constant reader, is Tabitha King. He's not shooting for millions of people. He's shooting to please one reader, and he's thinking of her. And I have a best friend. Steve's been my best friend my entire life. And Steve's always liked the humor in my writing. He's never enjoyed any of the darker things I've written, the horror and stuff. And maybe I'm thinking, like, Steve would have fun with this tale. And maybe that part of, and here's the funny thing. Steve's terrified of werewolves. And even though you don't really, it's not the half man, half wolf that he's terrified of and has nightmares of, he refuses to even pick them up, even though he probably is the person who inspired me to write them. And they're not what he thinks they are, but he's too scared. I think that's so ironic that, the person I'm maybe thinking of writing it for is never going to read them.
Yeah. All right. So now the part that I was looking forward to addressing on this on this last 15 minutes here now. So there's been three authors who I've interviewed who have this penchant for including the lyrics of a specific group, Rush, in their books. You and Craig Martell and Kevin Anderson. There's no doubt more, but these are three that I've talked to, and it just really struck me as like, wow. So, and then you take it to a whole new level on using lyrics and puns off of lyrics, you know, Hex in the City, come on.
Yeah.
You know? So is that part of your, I don't want to use the word shtick because I don't want to like downplay it.
Yeah.
But it's a definite characteristic of yourself as an author. You use lyrics a lot, and specifically you go after Rush. So spill it.
Well, if I was wanting it to be, if I was shooting for a large audience, I probably would have picked the Rolling Stones or Beatles or something, right? But I picked a band that I'm very passionately, intimately in love with. And I am a lyric fan in general. And Rush is, I got into the music because of Neil's lyrics. And I think I'm thinking of people like me. I remember reading Kevin J. Anderson's first novel, and I did not know Kevin back then. And I went, that's a reference to something from Grace Under Pressure. That's a reference to something from this other song. This is a reference to this third track on Moving Pictures. And I thought that was so cool that I picked up on it. And I thought, he's doing that for people like me. And I like that. I like those Easter eggs. So that was fun. And I have made it, with the exception in the shorter pieces like the novellas, or the romance one I wrote with Julie, because that was just a different feel. It was meant to be a sort of separate piece from the stories. My chapters have to have cheeky, tongue-in-cheek titles, and often they're play on lyrics. Like, you know, when you get caught between the moon and New York City, that's not a Rush lyric, but I definitely have fun with those. And again, if a Rush fan picks it up, oh, they're in for a treat. And they may not, and it's going to come as a surprise, because nowhere on the cover does it say, Rush fans, you're going to love this.
Yeah. What's funny, too, is Craig Martell uses, I don't know if you've read any of his books or not yet, but he used them in the first book I read of his, The Operator, in the series. And he loves Rush. He's always playing it.
Yeah.
And the girl he falls for doesn't like Rush, you know, just has her own opinion about, you know, that band there, that Canadian band. And he's just like, he's got to have, and she finally starts coming around and, okay, we'll play this as our song. But it's, have you found that there's like, that's a universally accepted band in lyrics, or is it something that's like very niche, you know, to.
Yeah. It's a great question. I think it's probably a lot. I mean, they are gigantic when you think of the fan base, but based on the overall fan base of music, probably not. They've never wanted to be that popular band. So fans like Craig and Kevin and I, when we find one another, it's 10 times more powerful than, yeah, I like the Beatles. Right?
Yeah.
And that maybe makes us even more passionate to want to just put another Rush Easter egg in there.
So, okay, that makes sense. I can think with that. So now when you write and you write in these lyrics in there, it's like, do you work backwards from the lyrics, or do you, you're writing along and then the lyric, you just, all of a sudden the lyric pops in your head and you plug it in?
That's how it happens. It pops up. Just like in normal conversation, where word association suddenly leads me into, and I know there's someone in your life that does that, that the lyrics come out all the time in the middle of conversation, and you look at this person and go, wait, what? And I love people like that. I that's the way I think, and therefore when I write, it happens. I don't necessarily plan it, and it's so fun when it happens. That's just a really special time.
Yeah, and then, so when you think of these lyrics, is the music happening with, you know, in your head, or is it the whole thing there, and you're just, what you're putting down there, and it's totally fine if the reader goes in their head that they got Neil's drums happening or whatever?
Well, sometimes I end up getting the earworm in my head, and I end up stopping writing and appreciate my memory of the song.
Uh-huh.
That does happen. But I will often hear the rest of it and then have to tell myself to stop because I have work to do and I'm having too much fun. Okay, too much fun. Let's go. Let's get back to work here.
So based upon book reviews, fan reviews, letters, mail, has that been like something that as a standard for you that makes you like different authors have different qualities? They're like, oh yeah, I like his blah.
Yeah.
Is that something that you find responsive from your fans?
Yeah. And it's not called out by a lot of people. A lot of people just talk about the story and the characters, but there are comments from readers who recognize what I'm doing with the chapter titles. And I like that can be an element of my branding and that's because it's part of Michael and the branding and the cheekiness and the wry humor and stuff like that. Not all my books have that.
Mm-hmm.
That's an element of who the main narrator is because he kind of commands that voice. In Lover's Moon, where it was pure duet narration, we didn't have chapter titles. It was just 1, 2, 3. Julie and I struggled with Hex in the City because she struggled with those chapter titles. And she said, okay, you write the titles for Gail's chapters because I can't do this. This is not me. I'm like, okay. And so that's why when we were thinking about Gail's chapters, maybe don't have those and Michael's will.
Mm-hmm.
But that I wanted, Gail has elements of her that are very eccentric and different.
Oh,
and
for sure.
And I wanted Gail's voice because the chapter, it was also a nod to old fiction where there's almost a summary at the beginning of this chapter that tells you what's going to happen. And sometimes I'm doing that and I'll sometimes reference lyrics.
You call it old. These days it's called metadata.
Yeah, metadata, yeah. But when you think about like that, I remember that is like, and the chapter in which Mr. Hetherington sits down finally with his grief, you know, and there's this like sub chapter. That actually helps me when I'm just looking at the outline, I'm like, oh, it must be chapter 22 because of what I wrote there. It's a clue for me. It's like a sticky note.
That's good. So now because what I'm looking for, because obviously this is, you know, Writers of the Future, and it's I'm trying to give people different ideas of what they can do and what they can use to help them on their current, on their way. And you've got these things with this that you obviously use with the Canadian Werewolf series, you know, using these Easter eggs that you're talking about, you know, but using lyrics and songs and just clever tongue-in-cheek, you know, reference and innuendo. Is that like, that's you, you know, that's like, this is my style? Is this like your voice or how does that fit in there like that?
It is probably the closest to my narrative fiction voice than anything else. I have an author voice for helping authors, which is different, but also has humor in it. And that's just part of it. But this definitely is, I think, yes, it's Michael, but it's also me heavily influencing that voice.
I'm just curious, we've talked about before, but just in terms of other authors, and obviously this is the Writers of the Future and the competition, and we're at year 40 now. Is there anything you can talk about, because you were a keynote speaker, you know, a couple decades ago or so, on the impact that L. Ron Hubbard's had on the genre of science fiction and fantasy through Writers of the Future?
Yeah, so, I mean, the impact and the inspiration is just incredible. It's immeasurable. You can measure 40 years, but you can't measure the impact that this contest has had on aspiring writers. And in inspiring writers, to do a little tongue twisty there. But I think one of the things, when I think about L. Ron Hubbard, I think about a writer who was way ahead of his time, a renaissance man. He was so many things, all the different, like ship's captain and all, like just never mind. But when you look at his fiction, he embraced pretty much every genre. He wrote, and he wrote on a typewriter, way harder than dictation or the tools we have today. in the Pulp Fiction, and this was how he made money to fund his adventurous things that he did and the exploring and all of that. And I look at today and we think about the future, and I was asked to speak about the future of publishing, you know, was that 10, 12 years ago or something? And I think that L. Ron Hubbard is a writer from that Pulp Fiction era who made a dramatic difference in the industry. But he's also, there's an element of what he did and what he does in writers of today, like the Craig Martels, who are producing high volume quality content that is going to impact a lot of people and continue to, and this is really all about paying it forward. And L. Ron Hubbard set that standard of paying it forward. You and I are here at this conference, Superstars Writing Seminars, as you witnessed, as we closed the events down today. This is about writers wanting to help other writers to continue, because we know the power of what happens if a writer continues to work hard and makes that effort, puts those words down on paper, and changes the world for the better.
Absolutely. That's very well said on that. And just to be able to make sure everybody knows how to find you as an author, where do they go and what do you recommend? I mean, obviously, I'm going to say, okay, here you go with your Canadian Werewolf, starting with volume one. But how do people find you and what do you recommend as...
MarkLeslie.ca, my website, and links to the social medias and all the other places I'm online are linkable from there, and my books as well. I do have, I think, so this time around, the short story, 10,000 words, on most ebook platforms is free. Mm-hmm. And the whole idea is I want people to, well, check it out. If you like it, I got more. If you don't, you didn't waste that much, 45 minutes, right, reading the 10,000-word story. And even the audiobook version I put up on YouTube, even though you can buy it for $2 or something, I thought, hey, if you like audiobooks, listen to this for free. I got more because I hired Scott and Sarah to do the narrations. And that's pretty much it. I think that's a good one. I do have nonfiction books for writers. But again, it's really hard. I don't want to recommend something if that's not your cup of tea. Mm-hmm. So I'd rather, like, I write different things. I write horror. I write horror, a lot of horror. I write true ghost stories as well, and they're all out there and available, and usually the online.
And they're all under Mark Leslie?
All that is under Mark Leslie. Only Mark Leslie Lefebvre is the guy who does the books for writers.
I get it. So then for books for writers, then Mark Leslie, and then add then...
Lefebvre.
Yeah, exactly.
Good luck spelling
L-E-F-E-B-V-R-E.
It. Oh my God, that's
get that.
Brilliant.
L-E-F-E-B-V-R-E.
And he doesn't even have the words in front of him, the letters in front of him. He did that off the top of his head. That's impressive. That's magic.
There we go. So, again, this has been great having this chat with you. And I hope that you guys listening to this stuff, you really are taking advantage of this, of what it can do for you to be able to expand your skill set as an author. And thank you for listening. Subscribe to the Writers of the Future podcast wherever you get your podcasts. We've also been syndicated on the United Public Radio Network, where you can find these podcasts as well. Writers of the Future series can be purchased wherever books are sold in the US, Canada, the UK, Australia, and South Africa, and available everywhere via Amazon.com. We are especially appreciative of our sponsor, Carnation, for supporting this podcast. Carnation was introduced in 1899, and 2024 marks its 125th birthday. So Carnation has been making delicious milk products for 1 1/4 centuries and is still going strong. Writers and Illustrators of the Future are contests created by L. Ron Hubbard to provide a means for the aspiring writer and artist to be seen and acknowledged for 4 decades. It is free to enter and open to amateur short story writers and artists of science fiction or fantasy. Again, thank you very much, Mark.
Thanks so much, John.